And that, in that sequence, there are some really basic practices, and then there's some that are could be designed for cleaning up kind of certain patterns of reactivity that have been there maybe since childhood, right? And that are older. But I think it's helpful to think about it being a sequence where we start with more simple practices and then go into practices which are a little more complicated, complex, and so forth. So the simple ones really are kind of foundational practices would be, first of all, just tracking for reactivity of any kind, whether it's just feeling unpleasant on a hot day or whatever the source of reactivity is. There are multiple sources of reactivity, right? And some of them are fairly simple and they're connected with something unpleasant in the body. Some of them are more complex. They're connected with interactions, could be connected with what's happening in the larger world. And so I like to start with keeping it simple in terms of some practices which are more general. And that might be tracking for reactivity, really studying in general the pleasant and the unpleasant, right? So I know for me, a lot of my early practice was hanging out in meditation retreats and being with what was unpleasant, which normally I wouldn't have done. I would have immediately, I'm feeling a little uncomfortable in my body. Normally I would just shift posture, but I learned, there in certain instances it's valuable to stay with what's unpleasant, just to watch the conditioned tendency to get rid of the unpleasant or to grasp after the pleasant. So that kind of training is important, and
Well,
that.
I haven't done a lot of that actually.
No, yeah, I
But
wasn't
I've actually
speaking so
done
much. I wasn't speaking so much personally to you, but more generally to the group. So what I'm doing here is I'm giving a range of practices and really trying to point to the more general practices, especially. Now, there is a whole class of, I guess there's several classes of reactivity which are quite habitual and a little more individual, right? A lot of what we can look at is more just what happens when we have our body, that we can be reactive when the body feels uncomfortable and so forth. That could be there for most people, but there are also certain distinctive habitual patterns that are there because of our particular histories or our particular biographies or could be related to residues of trauma, for example. Could be a lot of different things. And so, I mean, it's almost that given that the goal of Buddhist practice, on my interpretation, is to end reactivity, there are going to be a lot of different modes of reactivity that we work with. It's not just one mode. And so, a very important mode that I particularly work with in the context of working on transforming the judgmental mind is what we could call limiting beliefs that generally are there from childhood but can develop later. Limiting belief like, I'm not good enough, or could be, I mean, they're usually simple, or I need to be perfect, or, in a more sophisticated version, I will only receive love if I'm perfect, right? Or I can only feel good if I'm perfect. Or they're generally in three categories: about oneself, about one's relationships, or about the world. So it could be a limiting belief, the world isn't safe, right? And I could have all sorts of forms of reactivity based on very quickly not feeling safe. I could, not want to be with this person or that person, or want to get out of a meeting. And so these limiting beliefs are very old. And, to go into detail on working with them would take more time than we have now. But generally, actually, I gave a talk in a retreat on Transforming the Judgmental Mind, which goes into a lot of depth. It's called it's more or less four steps in transforming limiting beliefs. And that would be from September 2018. It's available on Dharma Seed. But essentially, people are at very different places. The four stages are first accessing the limiting belief, and then being in the presence of limiting belief, where you get to see it really, really clearly. Thirdly, transforming it. And fourth, integrating that transformation into daily life. Now, most people are at the first stage, where they're accessing it and learning how to get closer to it and see what it is. Some of us already know what it is. You know, I'm not good enough, or this part of me isn't okay, right, or something like that. And so the process is to go through this step-by-step process, which you can, and you can start noticing it. In the case of the judgmental mind, that's a form of reactivity. So you start noticing it when that occurs, and you're a little bit like a detective. For some people, it can take a year or two really to get a sense of the limiting belief. Some people already know it from therapy work or other work and so forth. But that's one aspect of working with reactivity. So I hope that starts to get at it. Like I say, I have an hour version of that on Dharma Seed, which is available. But the starting point is really noticing it. And again, like we were talking about, I think, with Liz, and maybe it's also Veda, one of the main tools is to move out of the conceptualizing and the narrative into the body and the emotions. Because otherwise, one spins around in circles. Right, and so a lot of the reactivity can take the form of narratives, like you were saying, narratives or stories repeated over and over and over again, with different variants depending on different people, different situations. So the way to work with that is to start to get towards the sense of limiting belief. One of the ways is to move out of the narrative realm into the body and actually start feeling what is painful beneath the narrative, to actually come in touch with the pain beneath the narrative is almost always a strategy to avoid pain, emotional pain especially. And when we can go into the body, it gives us a way of touching that pain, which in many cases will have the narratives not occurring so much. Of course, we have to have resources to work with pain, especially when it's a lot. So anyway, so there are all these subtleties and complexities here. So that's a start. Yeah. Anyone else wanted to report about noticing reactivity in the last period of time? Over lunch, how many people studied pleasant sensations during lunch? Okay, anything to notice from that? Yeah, Sarah. You'll have to unmute.
Okay.
Yeah.
Am I unmuted now?
You are, yeah.
Yeah, okay. I was eating my lunch in front of a window looking at the water and a view, and I was so relaxed and happy, but I didn't get quite to the grasping attachment phase.
Yeah.
Because I guess I knew that everything would be changing and I'd have to get back to this, but I really did enjoy those moments. I was so happy. And I felt it in my body. I felt a relaxation, a warmth, sort of an opening.
That's great. So there wasn't much wanting or grasping.
No, I was just enjoying it, feeling grateful for it.
That's great. Yeah. Yeah. How many people had a similar experience that you could be with the pleasant, but it wasn't too much wanting or grasping? And how many people felt mostly not much wanting and grasping, but occasional wanting and grasping occurring, just a little bit, right? That could be just like, oh, this is really pleasant just to sit and be with pleasure. I should do it more, right? Or something like that, right? So good. And maybe one more, anyone else want to share about the experience over the break or lunch? Okay, maybe one more, Corey.
So, you know, I was really noticing, you talked about the conceptual, how we conceptualize when we're looking at things.
Yeah.
And so I sort of practiced with that and watched that at lunchtime too, and then tried to play with like the artist's view where they see shapes, they see different, they don't see the concept as much, you know, and just reflecting on that and noticing how challenging that can be, just to notice colors and shapes or to just take in visually versus that. Because when you first said it and you had us look around, I didn't get it quite as much. But over lunch, I really got it, how challenging it is to look at things.
That's right.
And not have all these concepts arise.
Yeah, really good point. And good connection with like artists, right? Because a lot of artists, I was thinking particularly as I understand the history of the Impressionists, for example, in Europe, that they were sort of fed up with what we might call conceptualized art, which fit rigid models, right? You have to do it this way. And they were trying to get back to the lived experience just of the shapes, forms, colors. So if you look to Impressionists, you know, or think of Van Gogh or Cezanne or some of these people, Matisse, you can see the results of them trying to unhook vision from conceptualizing and just get to the raw sense experiences. And it's totally a parallel for what we're doing in meditation, right? We're trying to do something very, very similar. It's hard with vision. It's easier generally with the other senses, you know, but it's a very interesting point. So, you know, you can look at art with that sense, you know, like, okay, they said the conceptualizing of visual experience is really a problem. How do we get out of that? Right. And of course, it's not necessarily a problem. It's useful in certain ways. But and so this is really for us that would fit under our practices related to impermanence. And also will come up some in this segment when we work with a sense of self. Great. So I wanted to just do one thing, which I was going to do at the end last time, but I forgot to, or not forgot to, but there wasn't time. I just wanted to say a word about Donna. And I think most of us, how many people are very familiar with Donna? Okay. And how many people are not so familiar with Donna? Anyone? Okay. Let's see. Like, keep your hands up. I don't see anyone on this screen. Anyone not very familiar with Donna? Okay, so people are pretty familiar, so I'll be very brief. Again, it's the way that we work with Marin Sangha, that we try to keep the teaching off the market, so to speak, not set a fee, but then the basis for the whole Sangha is really that of knowing that one values something and wants to support it. So, you know, in Marin Sangha and many other places, there is a chance to support, you know, when we would be at the church and, you know, there's a fee for the rental, a chance to support that, which isn't the case now, but there still are some ongoing Marin Sangha expenses. And then for the teacher, and, you know, I, like many teachers, have virtually my whole livelihood is from Donna or being supported by people I work with. It's, you know, occasionally I'm invited places where they insist on giving me a fee. Not so often, but it happens, right? Like I was asked to guide part of a retreat for medical professionals, and they insisted on paying me. And it was okay, I did it. Anyway, most of my livelihood is from this support, so it's really appreciated. And Really, it brings our economics under guidance by our deeper values. So with Donna, we kind of see what feels right in the heart, and we offer something. And, you know, again, could be to the center and to the teacher. In this case, me. And I also like to say that I do retreats and I offer Donna to my teachers. So I'm in this role now, but sometimes I'm in other roles. So again, I think it's significant in that it's an experiment to not be dominated by the marketplace. And again, the way I practice is I try to see what seems appropriate in my heart, what feels like too much or too little, and get a sense of what feels right. And we also sometimes say that, you know, some people have less, and for them being generous might mean one thing, and some people have more, and for them being generous might, you know, would be different, and that in some ways the people who have more can balance the people who have less. So anyway, the mechanics of it, I think, are in the email. There's a link for the center, right, Bill? For Marin Sangha in the email?
Yes, there is.
Yeah. And then also in that email, I think it's there are two ways to offer Donna to me, or two main ways. You know, when I'm in person, sometimes people give me fruit or cookies or lettuce or something, but that's hard via Zoom. And so there are two ways of doing it. One is through PayPal. And the link is on there, and as well. It's basically just my email address, and that's in the email that Corey sent out. Was it last night, or this morning? And then secondly, one can also mail me a check at the address that's in the email, which is 1505 Holly Street. HOLLY, Berkeley, California, 94703. So I want to thank you in advance for support. It keeps me going. Sometimes we do Donna talks at the end because you have to decide whether it's a good thing to keep me going teaching. I don't like to do it at the beginning, but you have to, we're about halfway through, so you can make your assessment. Okay, so how many people are ready for not self? That's kind of a trick question. Okay, you ready for not self? This is the third of our areas, and I think in the last segment I'll probably have more discussion time, so we can come back and talk about any loose ends. This is the third. And two initial remarks about anatta. One is that as we work with anatta, we can begin to see more clearly how all three of these go together. We can begin to see, I mentioned this at the beginning, how there can be increasingly, and first in our meditation, then increasingly in our informal lives, in our daily lives, there can be a way that we tune in increasingly to the impermanent flow of experience with decreasing reactivity or sense of self. So the three come together in pointing to this way of just tuning into the flow of experience and having and noticing what gets in the way, and what typically gets in the way are forms of reactivity. You know, grabbing hold of the pleasant, pushing away the unpleasant, or some variant of that. And I'll interpret the times in which we have a strong sense of self, or even a moderate sense of self, as a form of reactivity. It's a main form of reactivity that grasping that comes, what we could call, from a sense of self. So that's the first comment, that we can increasingly see how all of these are interwoven. Essentially, that we can aspire to tune into a flow of impermanent experience, and we see what gets in the way. And as we work with reactivity and the strong sense of self, increasingly we open up that flow more and more. And so that's the first point. And then the second point is that of these three, not self is conceptually the most confusing. And I'm not going to give much of a conceptual explanation of not self. I'm going to try to be very grounded practically, which, and point towards essentially two ways of practicing to explore anatta or not self. One is by opening up more and more to that sense of the impermanent flow. It's learning first in formal meditation and then in experience more and more to be able to be with the flow of experience with no sense of self or less sense of self. And we already do that a lot, and I'll come back to these points. And then the first way we practice is we open up to more of a sense of the flow without any or much of a sense of self. The second way we practice is we look for when there's a strong, or what I call a thick, sense of self. When the self seems big or thick. And that would typically be when there's reactivity, self-image, self-consciousness, something like that. Okay, so first a few preliminary words. So I'll say some about anatta, and then we'll practice together, then we'll have a discussion. But those are the two forms of practice. And again, you can see how those two forms of practice tend to connect with what we looked at in terms of impermanence and in terms of reactivity, because the first form is really just learning better how to be with the impermanent flow. And the second form is particularly looking for when there's reactivity, particularly centered around some aspect of the self. So again, the three of them come together in an interesting way. So, first of all, a little bit about the term. Anatta is the word A-N-A-T-T-A. And I think literally it's best translated as not self. You'll hear it translated as no self quite often. I think that's not a great translation, and when I've talked with Buddhist scholars, they have agreed. Actually, the A in anatta, I think it's connected with the N there too, but the prefix in the word is actually has the same meaning as the prefix A in English words. Words like atypical or amoral, it simply means not, just like in those words. It's because Pali and Sanskrit are Indo-European languages and they share some of the grammatical features of English, believe it or not. And it's interesting, isn't it? And so the A is very similar to English words that begin with A. It simply means not. So that's an important thing. That being said, there is a lot of confusion, because what does not self mean? And again, I'll be a little mildly conceptual now before I go into those two practical ways of working with it. But it's, I think it's just very confusing, particularly when people think of it meaning no self. I heard a story from some of my students of a young man who was 20 or 21, went to a meditation retreat, heard that there was no self, went into tremendous existential angst and drama, dropped out of college, and was confused for quite a long time because he said, what's the point if there's no self? Right? So there's a lot to navigate. And in fact, even in the language, people talk about this phenomenon in different ways, that sometimes Buddhists actually talk about awakened beings or arhats as being like maha atta, which the atta is the word for self, maha means great. So even in Buddhism, we talk about there being a great self, which is similar to the term that was used for Gandhi, Mahatma, some of you may know, means something like great self. And there are other words in the Buddhist language where it seems like there's some kind of a self, and we talk sometimes about Buddha nature and so forth. So I want to just acknowledge that there's a certain confusion, and there's not really consistency necessarily in the text. And I thought I wanted to include something from Jewish humor. This is... Here it goes. The Torah says, love your neighbor as yourself. The Buddha says there's no self. So maybe we're off the hook. And so, yeah, so all sorts of roots for possible confusion. I mean, one of them is we don't even know what the self means in English. Right? Okay, so... are you starting to get a little bit confused? Can you feel it? Okay, I'm not going to go that direction. Just acknowledge that there's a lot of confusion, and maybe I'll mention one or two other aspects. Some people interpret not self to support them in what we could call spiritual bypassing. You know, that people say, there's no self, so I don't have to really attend to anything personal. I can just, everything's empty, right? And so people can, I've had discussions with, I can recall discussions with people who I thought really needed to develop more of a sense of self. And I remember talking with one person, and I say, you know, have you considered getting a job? The response was anger, right? And so is this familiar, some, that people can hide out between behind not self and use it as a reason not to take on certain developmental tasks? One of the quotes in my collection that we sent to everyone comes from, let's see, where is this? Comes from the psychologist Jack Engler. He wrote very influential essays in which he said, you have to be somebody before you can be nobody. He said, I wrote this nearly 20 years ago in an attempt to summarize my first effort at integrating two perspectives that appeared irreconcilable, Buddhist teaching about not self and newer psychodynamic thinking about the importance of self-development. And he goes on to just talk about how both are important. So there's, if we were going to be conceptual, I would try to navigate that. How do we talk about the development of the self and then the going beyond the self? But there's some also helpful perspectives and possible confusions. The other quote I have that I think is relevant from Earthlin Zenju Manual is that She is African American, and she reported being in Zen, and people told her, just drop the self, go beyond the sense of self. And so in this quotation I have here, she talks about the importance of people in marginalized or oppressed groups to clarify their own sense of identity and not just to assume that whatever is there is all conditioning. She expressed it like this. Although my teachers taught us the absolute truths of Zen practice, they seem to negate identity without considering the implications that identity can have for oppressed groups of people. The critique of identity overlooks the emotional, empowering, and positive effects of identity on those who are socially and politically objectified. And I think, again, this will be the extent of my kind of minimally conceptualizing, is that I think the way I resolve that is to look at this as developmental, that there are important developmental tasks that we have in the area that we call developing a sense of self, and that one can go beyond that sense of self, but does it at a risk if you use it as a reason not to deal with your own development. So I take a developmental frame, and a further quote that I have in the resources comes from Tanisaro Bhikkhu, and he says that a very similar model actually makes sense of the teachings of the Buddha, that it's really developmental, that Tanisaro Bhikkhu says you really need a sense of self early on in practice. You need a sense of self to be ethical, to hold yourself accountable, to hold other people accountable, to be responsible, and so forth. And he says, the Buddha taught the importance of developing a kind of sense of self before he went on to talk about going beyond the sense of self. So Tanisaro Bhikkhu says it like this, the issue is not what is my true self, but what kind of perception of self is skillful, and when is it skillful? What kind of perception of not self is skillful, and when is it skillful? A sense of self is an important part of the practice, especially a sense of self that encourages responsibility, heedfulness, and care. Sometimes you have to do one thing at one stage and then turn around and erase it at another. In the attainment of awakening, you put aside both self and not self. So I find that helpful to deal with some of these confusions. So does that make some sense? I'm just sort of, again, I think broadly speaking, the developmental way of seeing it is the most useful. That the teachings that we'll be looking at here, I think, can fit into that developmental sense. Okay, so the first aspect of practice, two aspects of practice, one has to do with developing more of a sense of flow, and the second has to do with more or less seeing what gets in the way of the sense of flow in terms of a strong sense of self. So this can be done in, I'm going to talk about two broad ways, one of them outside of meditation and one of them in meditation. Outside of meditation, we can get to recognize and try to open up to what could be called a sense of flow. How many people are familiar with that concept of flow that comes from the Hungarian psychologist with a difficult to pronounce name for many of us, Csikszentmihalyi. How's that? I think I got it. Csikszentmihalyi. So he says this, with flow, a person performing an activity is fully immersed in a feeling of energized focus, full involvement, and enjoyment in the process of the activity. In essence, flow is characterized by complete absorption in what one does. And typically, and interestingly, there's very, very little sense of self. Now, what's I think very important for exploring anatta is that we experience this a lot of the time. You know, when we're absorbed in our work, we're not thinking about ourselves, right? We're just doing things. Often when we're immersed in beauty, maybe dance or music or being in the forest or mountains, there can be a sense of just being with the flow of experience. And so one way of exploring the sense of just being with the flow of impermanent experience is to try to look out for these kind of experiences. Again, I think they're characterized by a lack of self-consciousness, very, very little or no sense of self. Again, you might experience this when you're dancing, maybe just on your own or in a place where you're just not thinking about how you look. You know, this may be what we experience in creative work, in art or music or writing. How many people can relate to some kind of activity where you're totally immersed and there's almost no sense of self? How many can relate to that? Yeah. And so look out for that. You know, it could be, yeah, it could be, you know, being immersed. I was just looking at Donna on the Zoom, and I was thinking of writing poetry, right? That, you know, in the writing of poetry, often it can just be a flow of creativity. And so the first way of accessing this is to tune into that. It could be in sports. One of my friends who lives in Oakland named Andrew Cooper wrote a wonderful book called Playing in the Zone, in which he actually looks at experiences very much like this that occur in the realm of sports, where people, in fact, they have a term for it called being in the zone, right? How many people have heard that term? Yeah, being in the zone refers to that sense of being with the flow and typically almost no sense of self. We can also experience this when we're with people we're very close to, and there's just a kind of being present. So the first way of practicing, or the first way of practicing this being with the flow experience in more ordinary experience, is to tune into those kind of experiences. And you can even invite them. When you've done that a lot, you can invite them. Let me do the dishes just with a sense of flow, right? Let me just be with the flow of experience in doing dishes. Let me in this walk just be more with a sense of flow, right? Let me in listening to this music, let me in this dancing. So that's one way. The second way is more meditative, more related to formal meditation. And this is actually the main way that the Buddha taught not self. He taught it through using the teaching of the five aggregates, which are the five dimensions of experience. They are basically form, which relates to the body, the feeling tone, pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, perception, sankhara, which refers to, for our purposes, it comes pretty close to thoughts and emotions, and then consciousness. And the Buddha said, look at your experience and just try to see one or more of these five. Don't see if you can look at experience and not see it in terms of me or mine. And so this is very close to how we practice mindfulness practice, where the invitation is, can you just be with experience when there's, be with the breath, notice the breath occurring. When there's a thought, notice a thought. When there's an emotion, notice emotion. We sometimes call this choiceless awareness. And when there's a pretty good level of concentration and our minds aren't real conceptual, we will often have a sense simply of the ongoing flow of experience. Oh, now I'm with body sensations. Oh, now there's a thought. Oh, it just lasted for a split second. Back to my breath. Oh, look, there is a sound. And we have to be pretty quiet for that to happen. But that is, how many people have had that kind of experience, some or often, like where you're just with that flow and you're just noticing, and you don't get caught in thinking very much. And for the most part, again, the instructions are be with that without as much as possible saying that's my thought or identifying with it or following it down a path, right? So that would be the instruction for, that's what we'll do in a moment. Those are the meditative instructions. Again, they're close to what we often do with mindfulness. They do presuppose pretty good stability of mind. So, yeah, those are the two forms of being with the flow. One in more ordinary experience, one in more meditative experience. And then the second broad area of practice, and by the way, this model is my own model. This is not a traditional model. The main way of studying not self traditionally is in what I just mentioned. And so the second way is to look out for when there's a thick sense of self or a big sense of self, a strong sense of self. This can come in all sorts of ways. It can come with self-consciousness, self-image. It can come with reactivity. It can come with, being caught in self-centered thinking, in what we were talking about earlier, the narrative, the storyline, right? And there can be a strong sense of self when we're judgmental. Some of what we were talking about earlier with related to limiting beliefs and old patterns may fit into this model. There's a strong sense of self. And again, what we do when we notice that is related to what we were talking about earlier. We can bring awareness to it, and sometimes we'll bring awareness to it and it'll just fade away. And then sometimes, the patterns, since the patterns can be related to those forms of reactivity related to limiting beliefs and very old patterns, sometimes what would be skillful is to do some of what we were talking about earlier. If it's lasting for a really long time, and we're noticing it, sometimes we can bring the attention into the heart area, into the chest. And, I call this the dropping down practice. We go from repetitive thinking about self into the body. This can happen when there are very old patterns. It can also just happen when we maybe are, I just had a difficult interaction with someone. I'm pissed off, to use a technical Dharma term. I'm pissed off, and I just go around in circles with my thinking about this bad person or whatever, right? And we can also, in those instances, with any repetitive self-centered thinking, it's useful to then bring the attention into the body and into the emotions. But one way of doing that is simply shift the attention to the center of the chest and hold it there lightly without trying to make anything happen, and just stay there. And sometimes when I have had that train of thought, why did that person do it? I might actually just get very quickly in touch with anger and say, oh, I'm angry. I didn't realize that. I was just going around in loops with the thoughts. So that could be, that's a very good way to work with a sense of self that can be repetitive in that way, that we want to notice it, and then we can see if we can go to the body. And again, with ones that are very old and familiar, there are further ways to work with those experiences which I mentioned earlier. Maybe just one further thing to say here, and this is important, is that having a strong sense of self, what I call a thick sense of self, doesn't lead to us thinking that we just need to drop the self, drop the phenomena, or go beyond it. It's a very important point, because sometimes that strong sense of self is something that we can just immediately drop, right? You notice it, you're really, I don't know, upset about something, upset about something going round and round in circles, and you just notice and you say to yourself, once you notice it, I don't need to be so upset. You just, maybe in some cases, it would be appropriate just to drop something. In other cases, one could do inner work with what comes up, as in the examples we've been given. In other instances, and kind of related to what I just said, in other instances, noticing a strong sense of self may be noticing an area where there is wound or a need for healing, right? And so this, again, is one of the subtleties that's not always there in the way people teach on not self. Noticing a strong sense of self may be telling you this place needs further healing and transformation, further work. How do you distinguish all these? Not so easy all the time, right? But if there's anything like trauma in our backgrounds or just places that we know are wounds, then the strong sense of self could lead me to say, gosh, that's really calling for attention. Let me give attention to it. So that's going back to that more the developmental sense that there are certain aspects of what we call ourself where it's important to heal, transform, and grow, right? And we're still, I think, moving towards a mature integration of that perspective with spiritual practice. In some settings, you won't hear people necessarily be very clear about those points. Okay, just to say that. Okay, so let's see, we're doing pretty well with time. Let me, maybe I'll ask, I've said a lot. That's the extent of my, what I wanted to present on anatta or not self. And so, any questions? I'll take a few questions now, not for too long, but any questions of clarification before we go into practice? Yeah, Nancy, please. You have to unmute.
There you go. My computer has frequently said, your connection is unstable and I miss what you're saying. It's just, you're just silent because there's something in my connection. So what did you say? In meditation, we practice the five: form, feeling, perception, something, and consciousness. The five what? What were those called?
These are called the five aggregates in aggregates. Okay. Translation. The original word would be in Sanskrit, it's skandhas, skandhas.
Thank you. And then what was after perception?
That is the term is sankhara, sankhara. It's the same term that was I mentioned in passing earlier,
right.
But I translated it more. This isn't literal, but it covers a lot of the same territory as thoughts and emotions. It also, okay, in the way it's presented, often has to do with habitual tendencies.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you. I like getting that message. Your internet connection, they should change it. Your internet connection is impermanent. Yeah. Okay, any other questions of clarification before our meditation? And I guess use the raise hands function, because I can't see everyone. Anything else, Bill or Corey? Okay.
Well, just one thing to mention, because a number of people see that problem with internet connection not being enough. Make sure if you are using Wi-Fi, make sure nobody else in your house is using Wi-Fi, because you really don't have enough bandwidth to have two people doing stuff. And also make sure that your computer isn't doing any downloads without you knowing about it, which happens a lot these days.
And the other piece is, if you have control, be as close to the router as you can be. That will help also. And if it's really, if it really gets bad, sometimes people just turn off the video and just use audio. Not optimal, but yours seems fine. Okay, ready for meditation? So people need to stand up for a moment? Why don't we take 1 minute just to stand up? And one thing I forgot to say about the Dana is that if possible, if you can take care of the Dana by the end of today, that would be appreciated. So if you can take care of the Dana by the end of today, and if possible, by the end of the day long, that would be appreciated. Okay, so that's a request. Okay, so let's go into our formal meditation. And we'll work with the two main practices. First, take a few minutes just to be with the breath, come back, stabilize attention. And then here are the basic instructions. Be with mindfulness practice as you ordinarily do it. For many of us, that would be staying with the breath, being with the sensations of breathing, noticing what becomes predominant. If it lasts for a while, staying with that while it's predominant. When it's no longer predominant, returning. So set up your mindfulness in the usual way, but add this particular instruction. Be with the flow of sensations, if you're with the breath. Notice when something else becomes predominant, might be a sound or a thought. See if you can just have a sense of the flow of one experience after another. Now there's the breath, now there's a thought, now there's a sound. Now I feel sensation elsewhere in my body. See if you can have a sense of the flow, one thing after another, a little bit like as if you're sitting with a river in front of you and maybe there's just been a storm and you're just watching one thing after another come by. And you're just watching them and tuning in to their nature. As much as possible without commenting or doing anything with anything. Just being with the flow. That's the first part of the instruction. And then secondly, if something gets in the way of the flow, involved with a sense of self, what I'm calling a strong or a big or a thick sense of self, notice that. Sometimes that will last for a while. If it lasts, bring awareness to it, and you can do so in some of the ways we explored. One way is just to stay with it, if it's particularly if it's maybe more bodily based. If it's a bunch of thinking, you can notice it and bring the attention down into the center of the chest and the body. When that strong sense of self is no longer there, just go back to your main focus area and continue the process. So basically, we're intending just to be with the flow and then seeing when there's a strong sense of self that gets in the way of the flow. Again, some of the main reasons it would be there would be, could be self-consciousness, self-image, reactivity, a lot of self-centered thinking and so forth. So that's the practice. Be with the flow. See what gets in the way of the flow, especially in terms of a sense of self. If you'd like to, you could now let go of the breath or let go of whatever your regular sort of anchor is, and see if you can be just with what we sometimes call a choiceless awareness, where whatever is predominant, let whatever is predominant come before you. Mind has to be fairly stable and quiet to do that, so if that's not the case, feel free to stay with the breath or your other focus, but see if you can just stay with that sense of flow without even choosing to be on anything, but letting whatever is predominant be there. We'll just do this for about 3 minutes or so. Just being with the flow of experience without choosing what's there, but noticing that flow, but also when you get stuck or when something gets in the way of the flow. We have a little bit of time if there are any observations from that practice. Any questions? Again, it's very, very simple, just to see if we can be with the flow of experience, which again is harder without some sense of stability of mind. So the backdrop for a lot of this practice is having pretty good concentration. That, like that earlier quote from the Buddha, one who is concentrated sees things as they are. So we need often to develop that concentration. But when there's some degree there, we can be with the flow and then just see what, as it were, gets in the way where there's reactivity. So any observations, questions, either about the practice or about anything that I said, and also could be anything left over that wasn't said earlier. Okay, I see Mary's hand. Okay.
This made me think of I've been doing morning sits with Gil Fronsdale, and we were talking about creating, I guess, how you find refuge. But one of the ways that he described it is instead of like selfing, it's like going from the point of view of a situational. Mm-hmm. So I thought of the flow, and this was really nice with what you said and what he said came together. Mm-hmm. And it was very spacious. So
what was very what?
Thank you.
What's that?
Yeah, I think you're freezing a little bit. I didn't hear.
It was very spacious.
Very spacious. Yeah. Go ahead.
That was really lovely. So thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, there can be a sense of spaciousness and ease. And when we come back, I'm going to do we'll do a longer meditation. And at the end of it, I'll take us into a little further levels of spaciousness, which can be very. But yeah, this is basically just letting go and saying, life, just keep going. I'm going to be here and kind of watch. Yeah. Thank you. Thanks, Mary. Nice observation. Was that Donna? Yeah. Okay.
Gotcha. So I had an interesting experience this morning with feeling into the reactivity of a moment that happened around the shopping list. And I recognized that I was triggered by my pattern of scarcity. Mm-hmm. But then I was remembering a few days ago when I wasn't triggered by that and when, in fact, I was feeling abundant. And mm-hmm. I suddenly, because it had to do with my husband and I, right, you know, suddenly it was this sense of not self, as though there was scarcity and there was abundance, and those things are happening within everybody, but it wasn't conceptual like that. It was just like, oh, those two things, as though they weren't attached to he and I particularly. So
yeah. Sort of a naturally occurring phenomena. Sometimes there's scarcity, sometimes there's abundance. You can just be with whatever's there, right? Something like that?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's nice, yeah. Can we be like that? A little bit, you say. Can we? Yeah. It's like, it reminds me of the teacher, Chan Sumedho. He often would say, it's like this. It's like this. Major reactivity. It's like this. Right? So yeah, thanks Donna. And probably better to use the raise hands function rather than raise your hand, because I can't see everyone. I can we've had 30, 31 people. I can just see 25 at a time. Okay. Is that Babs? Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, so Shinzen, my first teacher, used to have me merge with things to try to experience merging with things, yeah, in order to not feel the self, experience not self. Do you ever teach that?
I don't know if I teach that directly, but it's something that happens naturally, right?
So yes. Yeah. But it also can be a practice, like with a mountain.
Yeah.
It can be in trying to invoke that intentionally.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. Let's see. I think what I tend to teach are sort of different levels of the observer or knower. And at a certain point, I invite the observer or knower to leave. And that can occur in a few different ways. One way would be by merging. The other way would be by disappearing. So, but I think they go towards the same end, I believe, yeah. But yeah.
To let go of the witness, even. Let go of the witness.
Let go of the witness. But I think we could, sometimes when we would say, let's say, really, really be with the breath, there might, and this is what happens in concentration practice, there would be a felt sense of a kind of emerging. You know, when we say, really, really be with it, really, really be with the breath, really be with the sound, there could be a way that experientially the sense of self disappears, right? Yeah, so I think I haven't given that specific instruction, but a lot of where I might give instruction, something similar would happen.
Yeah. It takes a lot of concentration.
Yeah, it takes stability of mind, yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Thanks. Good. Anyone else before we'll go to a break in a moment? Okay, maybe last one would be Linda. Okay.
Excuse me. So, Donald, I have always appreciated your explanation of not self with this thick self and thin self. It was the first time I could ever really grasp a sense of what that meant. Mm-hmm. And I see when I'm reacting and involved in, and leaning into something, how thick I am. And as I can ease back on it, how that self thins out to not no self, but certainly not so much involved self.
Yeah.
And I had a question for you. During the lunch break, I was I've dealt with chronic pain for some decades, and I had some come up, and I said, okay, well, there it is, and I know it's not permanent, but then a part of my mind, I guess my story was, but I know it's going to come back, and how to deal with that part of it.
Yeah, how to work with that. I think probably a few ways to work with that. You'll have to see which works better in the moment. It sounds like it's could be connected with anxiety in some way or concern.
Yeah, I'm sure I'm anxious that it's going to return.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So probably two ways occur to me. I mean, in addition to holding yourself with compassion, right? So I think, you know, if it gets to be big, If it's just a thought and you very familiar with it coming up, you could just say, you know, not now. Let's not go there, right? Sometimes that's effective. If it feels stronger, it could be something that you work with and then go into the body and investigate, feel what's there. So I think it depends on the level of strength. But if it's very, very familiar, sometimes it could be most skillful just to say, you know, not now. We talk about that like training a puppy.
Yeah.
Not now.
Right.
But sometimes it's useful. So sometimes it's useful to go into something, sometimes not.
Right. I guess what I was saying at that moment, I wasn't being grabbed by it. But yeah. I was grabbed by the fear of it returning again because it's chronic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's also very understandable that there would be that thought. I would say you should be probably just very, very familiar with that thought, right? That occurs all the time, you know? And so can I, you know, acknowledge that it will come back and just not go there. That's one strategy. Again, if it feels strong, you can be with it. The aim would be, you know, essentially that could be a form of shooting the second arrow. And we want to minimize the shooting of the second arrow, right? And so, again, different strategies depending on, I think, how strong it is. Does that get at it some?
Yeah, you know, I think this was the first time I really looked at the anxiety I have about it recurring.
Okay, well then, investigation would be very good.
Yeah.
Right, to be with it, maybe at some future time after you've invested. Usually, just letting go and saying not now, mm-hmm. it either have to be very light or it's something we've looked at 100 times, right? And it sounds like if you haven't looked at it, then it's good to look at it some. Yeah. Feel the anxiety, notice that, hold it with compassion. Okay, thank you. Okay, so we have a little less than 25 minutes now for another walking period, personal time. People in Arlington, Virginia and Philadelphia may have supper coming up. I don't know if you can fit it in a short time, but maybe a snack. Okay. And so if you'd like to do walking or do some more sitting, stay with what we just did. You know, that combination of being with the flow of experience and looking for when that, which thank you, Linda, I've sometimes called that thinning the self. And then also look for when the self appears more thickly. So one of those, you can work with that practice, or if anything else from earlier in the day calls you. And when we come back, we'll come back right into meditation. I'm going to start when we come back, which would be at 3:30 Pacific time. We'll start with a longer meditation. It'll be probably half hour or just a little under half an hour, in which we'll have a little more time to work with it. I'll do some review of where we've been, but then also take it a little further. Okay, so we'll come back to a little bit longer meditation. So know that we'll sit some if you want to stretch, take some walks and so forth. Okay, so we'll come back then. So thank you and see you in a little bit.